going on, everybody? Welcome back to The Gods Will Not Save You, The Wire Revisited. I'm Willie.
Hi, Willie. This is Jakob, and good evening to all out there. This is a podcast where Willie and I, the co-hosts, will be going through each and every episode of the hit HBO show The Wire.
Right on. Thanks for that energy there, Jakob. Anybody out there that wants to donate, anchor.fm/thegodswillnotsaveyou/support. As always, leave us 5 stars on iTunes. If you want to follow us on social media, y'all know the drill. Today, we're here to talk about season 4, episode 8, Corner Boys.
Wild stuff happening in this episode. Another journey through the Wire universe, the simulation, twists and turns, you know, things popping out at every corner.
Right.
Get us started, man. I mean,
well, Presbo, first of all, is learning that the No Child Left Behind program is more like the No Child Behind Left program, as I've heard some people say about the controversial Bush era policy that placed an emphasis on standardized testing.
Oh, yeah, I was not a fan. I mean, I won't get into personal reasons, but...
Yeah. I mean, this show has a pretty, like, clear-cut agenda against that type of schooling, so I think it's okay.
No, I'm just saying, like, I suffered because my test scores in certain areas might not have been what was, like, deemed appropriate or proficient.
Yeah.
So I was placed maybe in, like, this is, like, remedial math class to help you get your score up.
That's so crazy because you went to a 4-year college and got a degree and everything. Like, you're a success story. You work for
No Child Left Behind. Help me then. Everything you just said. I mean, I got moved out, but not everyone had a parent that was like, no, you know. So then I was a TA for someone who just liked to listen to KBLX and have really tasty smelling instant oatmeal that I had to sniff.
Wow.
I didn't get any.
Yeah, so it was like Presbo eating his sandwich in front of you, but not even letting you get his leftovers, basically.
I mean, kind of, but like if it was an empty room and I was like a privileged little white kid, not from Baltimore.
Mm-hmm.
Anyways.
Presbo can't get any of the kids in the class to answer the question correctly the way he wants them to. He picks on this guy, Tay, who's in the middle of like telling jokes to Randy. He's like trying to get him to show his work. And the reasoning behind him giving the correct answer is because, quote, B has all the dinks.
So where does dinks factor into this? Because isn't dink a term used for other characters?
Oh, that's inky dink. Oh, yeah.
it's like what's going on, man? You know, we got to overanalyze everything. Like if you know, our project is kind of just like dinking certain aspects of the universe to death. Right. How can we just... Are you out there? Do you all understand where we're coming from?
Yeah, Turtle Wells, Linwood, Rudy Williams.
Ding, like, ding, ding. Power moves, power moves, power moves.
Yeah,
Willie.
Daryl Davis.
No. Oh, yeah. The list goes on. One day we'll come to you with a, you know, like a supercut, a dink supercut.
There you go. But basically the whole summation of this interaction... basically concludes with Prez realizing that he's not really teaching the kids anything that has, you know, value to it. He's not imparting any like real wisdom or knowledge when he's just reiterating what's on the test. And so he's having like a little like mini existential crisis. There's a scene with him in the teacher's lounge lamenting this very fact. And, someone gives him like the cryptic advice, like your first year is all about you surviving, not about the kids surviving, or something to that effect. Grace wants him to find middle ground. Yeah.
Where does middle ground factor into it all, right? Wasn't Kurt Schmoke in the episode middle ground? And now he's like someone who was involved in the schools. And then, so I was like, simulations. Like, what's going on there, man? Like, Kurt Schmoke involved, you know, as mayor, he was doing school stuff. And
right.
Now, you know, Grace is talking about middle ground.
Yeah. But that...
Sorry. So stupid.
But usually it seems like middle ground has kind of like a bad connotation within the context of this show, because it's shown that the possibility of reform is quite low. But Grace does like have some like actual useful advice for Przybylowski. Just like basically when the higher ups are watching, stick to the format, and then like you can in the rest of your time, you know, come up with your own formula of how you want to reach these kids or teach them. That is Prez's little journey throughout the episode. You want to talk about what's going on in the special corner kid class?
I mean, I had like a few more things to offer up about Prez.
Sorry,
you know, unless you don't want to hear them.
No, I do, please.
So, I may have talked to you or not about this prior to us getting on wax here. So earlier on in this season, Prez is with Dookie down in the basement, and they are looking for all of the dice and things like puzzles and games in an attempt to almost subvert the puzzle palace, which is out for new teachers who might not be teaching to the test.
Right.
Like, what is that all about, Willie? Dink, 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 dink.
Yeah, this is our version of dinking.
Dinking it to death. I don't know, man. Yeah, it's pretty crazy. I mean, maybe we'll talk about things like school district and the state and all that. Is this the time? Is there going to be another time for me to pull out the little quote I had here?
Go ahead.
We could fit it in.
Because somebody's like, oh, we're at risk of getting taken over by the state. And Prez is like, well, maybe we should be getting taken over the state. What is the, do you know, like, what the actual outcome of that would look like? Why that is such a, like, scary thing that so many teachers are afraid of? Or
I mean, from what I looked at, as far as the school district's concerned, it was a much earlier timeline, specifically the book I was showing you, Black Social Capital, The Politics of School Reform in Baltimore, 86 to 98 by Marion Orr. Shout out. Great stuff. Very dense and over and over my head and beyond me. But okay, so there was a lot of conversation, you know, regarding that in Kurt Schmoke's term as mayor, as you know, Most of that falls within, you know, that timeline. He was there from what, like 87 to 99. So pretty much like most, all this book is related to, you know, to that span of time where he was involved. I mean, Baltimore is unique in some ways. And again, I'm going to have to go back and reread a lot of this, or if I'm able to, because it's very complex. But Donald Schaefer, the mayor prior to Kurt Schmoke, kind of William Donald Schaefer, yeah, he kind of not like gave the you know, power over the school district up to the black community, but you know, like it's not like some benevolent thing where he's like, oh, you know, I'm the mayor, but you know, here, you know, majority of my city, who's, you know, comprised of African Americans, you all can, you know, have control over the school district and decision making and all that. Because he was really focused on the convention centers and that kind of thing, like what we're going to hear about with Carchetti and, you know, right, when he's being advised and talking with Norm, where, you know, so like it's kind of decentralized. There's a lot of other organizations involved in the school district, like BUILD, which was Baltimore United and Leadership Development, which had like a huge, you know, influence, you know, made up by the like, ministers and all that. So, you know, there's like foundations, a lot of moving parts, but, you know, Kurt Schmoke was dealing in like near the end of his term in 98, there's a agreement made between Baltimore and the state. And not everyone was happy with this. Pete Rollins, who was, I think, a delegate, He was a delegate. It was Stephanie Rawlings Blake's dad who became mayor, I think, after Sheila Dixon. So, like, after O'Malley and all that. He was, like, instrumental in forging a deal to get Baltimore more funding and was like, hey, it's not all bad if, you know, we're getting state funding. But then people down in the counties, like Montgomery and the more affluent areas were like, why are we giving all this money to Baltimore? And it was like Baltimore bashing was something you did to, you know, gain popularity in those areas.
Jesus.
But then people on the side, you know, in Baltimore, who I'm going to get to, that's where this is all leading, were also not, you know, happy about it, even though the deal did go down. So from a friend of the show, Frank Reed of Bethel AME Church and Kurt Schmoke's stepbrother, which anyway,
I don't know if we got to that,
but yeah, so, hey, it's all connected. Basically it in, Black Social Capital, this was said, you know, paraphrasing a verse from scripture, Reed asks, what does it profit a city to gain $254 million and lose its soul? Wow. So some strong words of commentary on the deal between, you know, the city and the state. So, I mean, not everyone liked it, but that's just one example, of course. Maybe a little anticlimactic there, the way I set that up. But, yeah. I mean, it's like, it's so complicated because this is, you know, this season's obviously much further along the line, you know, in the 2000s, if that's what they're, you know, depicting, because sometimes in the show, we know it's like, where are we in the simulation? Like the 80s, the whatever.
Yeah. And like the first season, they were all using beepers and like the technology is already.
So what, you know, where in the city, what, which time, you know, time,
Timulation.
Yeah. What timulation? Yeah. What's inspiring this this moment here? Because I'm sure, like more recently, I mean, things are getting taken over by the state. But I mean, even I think where we went to school, there was always whisperings like, "Oh yeah, if you guys don't do well on the test, like they're gonna come in." You know, certain like schools have already been taken over by the state. I don't know if that was just like you know, tall tales and kids being kids, but. I mean, you would maybe know some stuff about that. Or?
Oh, no, that's what I'm asking. Like, what does that entail? Like,
just
why
is like, you can, from my experience, they can just shut down like extracurriculars and just like math.
Focus
ELA,
on
math, ELA, math, ELA. And everyone's just drilling the subjects that your school is chronically deficient in, which what did they test for? I mean. Science was one of the options for a while, but it was mostly just reading and math. So, but yeah, I mean, we see we can infer the words that Frank Ree would have had for old Prez based on his comments, which you were, you know, keen enough to bring up, where he's like, maybe we should, you know, it's like, okay, sell your soul then.
Prez is still a newbie, though. He's still a rookie. Probably doesn't understand the implications of taking that dangerous of a, you know, endorsing such a radical idea. Yeah. But
I mean, you know, it's just like Baltimore is already dealing with a lot and feeling like the state is, you know, intruding.
Yeah.
It's like, I don't know. It's just in a tough place, the city. So
it's a double whammy.
Yeah. Like, what do you do? I'm ready to talk about Bunny.
Yeah. So he, throughout this episode, they finally seem like they're kind of like cracking the code and how to reach some more of these troubled kids by like opening up the floor to them, to give perspective on what life is like in their day-to-day existence with, you know, surviving out in the corner and selling the drugs and stuff like that.
Violence and squalor. Jesus.
Naaman lands a couple like good hits when he's talking about like hypocritical it is that you know, they're getting shit on all the time for selling drugs to the community, but this lady, can't remember her name, but she's like a doctoral candidate.
Duquette?
Miss
Duquette?
Parenti's really impressed with. He's saying, like, you know, you guys got a Amron and you probably have cigarettes in your bag and everybody's like drinking all the time. So like, how is that much different from us? And it kind of like brought me back to maybe like some of our like discussions we were having in season two, where it's like, oh, everybody gathering at the watering hole is just like a slightly more upscale version of the shooting gallery that Bubs finds himself in.
Well, oh, these guys are junkies, man. They're no better than a heroin addict.
No, that's, I don't feel that strongly.
Ott and all these guys.
I don't feel that. Well, I mean, I do feel a lot of like compassion for like Bubs and all of them for just like, but I, you know, it's not a direct, just direct line of comparison.
Just your Tuesday, Savage Willie takes.
Jesus. Okay, it's not that bad.
I'd rather be stomped in the gutter than have some kids ask, oh, should we get the shovel? Their words, sticks and stones.
Oh, man. Yeah, anybody who has been paying attention this whole time knows that me being stuck in that classroom with... with some rowdy kids would be like my worst nightmare, and I wouldn't have like any way to defend myself really. But
it's good, man. Like, you'll never have a crappy backup plan being a sub. So you'll just like, you know, don't even have to think about going down that route. So like, success is my only option. But if I had to be a sub, like, I'm going to die.
I don't know. We'll see about that.
Well, but what led you on your path to become an educator? Well, you know, I just really took a look in the mirror on my project, The Gods Will Not Save You, and helped me realize that, you know, I really can, you know, reach these children.
Without like constant fear of, you know, retaliation. Or public humiliation. So anyway, yeah, so they kind of like crack the code a little bit in like getting them to like open up about, you know, what their code of ethics is like out there in like the business world. And like they even get them to collaborate at one point to like write down like everything they know about this, since they know they can't get suspended. And they're like surveying the kids on like what they want to be when they grow up. And like a lot of people say they want to be NBA. Some people say they're probably going to be dead by then anyway. But Albert says that he wants to be like Ben Carson, who, you know, playing the long game this show. Like, they probably didn't even know like all the implications that that little reference has and how this is aged and, you know, how Ben Carson is generally not looked upon favorably now. Brilliant surgeon, but, you know, in terms of his politics, they're questionable.
Yeah. Well, didn't David Simon point to this when people asked him, really? You know, do you have regrets or things that age? He's like, yeah, that whole Ben Carson thing, not so good.
Oh, really? That's funny.
Yeah. That is funny. Oh, he's a neurosurgeon over at Johns Hopkins. Great stuff. Great guy. Yeah.
Ah. Like, we're way ahead of you, Parenti. You're canceled.
Oh, man, don't cancel him.
But
hey,
yeah.
Parenti, come on the show.
But yeah, Darnell, he's pretty like blacked out drunk in like some of the other episodes. But...
Yeah, he's not blacked out. He's hungover, man. Okay. You're like, Darnell is blacked out. Darnell is in the corner because he came to see him. Darnell is hungover because he was doing cocaine. I'm in a shotgunning a blunt with Albert in the hallway. Oh, no.
Albert, the little kid?
Nah. Like, who has the most... I don't want to talk bad on him because he's, like, you know, makes me, like, sad. Like, yeah. That scene later on with his mom and stuff.
Yeah.
Probably, like, one of the worst, you know, scenes in my opinion.
Yeah.
Anyways, I don't want to talk bad on him, so maybe I shouldn't have used him in my little joke. Doing a callback to the time where Willie gave us one of the most brilliant takes on Cuddy.
I just, it's a mouthful.
Coming to you on the Supercut 2022.
2023. Who are we kidding? Yeah. We're going to be doing this till the end of time.
Simulation. Yeah. Hey, I just had to rewatch The Deuce real quick. We're going to pause recording. I'm just like, all right, we've each rewatched every David Simon show three times. Can we finish season five now?
Now we got to get to Homicide finally. Oh, no. They're never going to release it on Peacock. We got to get the DVDs.
All right, sorry.
But yeah, Darnell seems like he's Mr. Big Shot. He knows what's going on, but kind of gives a...
Was blackout drunk. He's giving some really solid takes, by the way, for being blacked out, according to Willie.
No, I'm saying in like other episodes, like he seemed like really out of it.
You know? Yeah, he was pretty wasted. Yeah. I don't think he was just hungover. But I'll give you that one.
Yeah, but this one, he's like motivated, like, yeah, I'm going to go get my education and talk about like what it means to lose a good worker and like what happens when someone messes up the count. Like, this is fun. Like, my environment. Pretty brilliant.
My environment.
I get to reflect on my environment. It's like the one way, like they like hacked introspective thinking in these kids. Like they totally like conned them into opening up and like getting a decent education. But you know, Naaman has some good points about big tobacco and all that corporate greed.
Omar's coming for that ass, Naaman.
Nice.
Bunny's giving them a talk, you know, getting them all, you know, like instigating or whatever he's doing. Oh, you know, you're just getting over. You're just practicing getting over for, you know, out there on the corner.
Right.
And then he's saying like, you know, ain't no real consequences, ain't no real cops. And I'm like, every other episode, there's some uniformed cop like 2 feet away from Naaman or whoever's right. Like mugging them, just like, just give me a reason, you know?
Yeah.
I'm like, there's real cops everywhere. You're, you know, obviously they know he's a cop.
Right.
Or ex-cop. So disgraced major on a lieutenant's pension.
Not in the academic circles.
Yeah, he's well respected. But yeah, I mean, there's always cops around, so I don't get that.
Officer Walker is breaking kids' little fingers, or little kids' fingers. He's breaking
kids. He broke his index too. Again, we don't laugh at like the terrible things of the show. It's just sometimes it, like Willie has said, it's hard to talk about a lot of this stuff.
I think my delivery is like unintentionally robotic sometimes.
It's so bizarre sometimes. It's hard not to be like, what the Jesus.
I don't know. I can't help it.
I'm Audi 5000.
Nice. Like Tay said after he talked about the dinks.
What are dinks?
So, do we have anything else we want to talk about from this Tillman section?
No, I mean, it was cool, like, seeing Dookie get a little attention.
Right.
Like, he's trying to, you know, help do some online shopping. It's kind of like Herc doing his little, like... But this is, you know, like, can you make it, you know... For a second, I thought he was designing, you know, them some jewelry, like, models. Because... just thinking back, I'm like, man, is this as far as like Dookie ever got, like, not it's romantically, like, but I mean like attention from women, because from here it's just gonna go all downhill, like,
right?
I'm like, he's man, like, that's his like memory, you know, if he, assuming he likes girls. But it's like, right. Hey, yeah. Man, like Dookie, you could have, you know, you're like great kid,
right? And this is like probably like the one stretch of time that he has like in the show where he's you know, not smelling really bad,
not
like
living not squalor.
Yeah, he's only living in slight squalor because Prez is giving him a helping hand.
Yeah,
pretty tough. Yeah, pretty tragic.
So what's our next
I was wondering if you wanted to indulge me, we could then like jump to the section about the boys outside of school.
Oh yeah, that's great stuff. Because we're talking about it.
Yeah.
I'm not indulging anything. I mean, this is just the way I did it. Not final. yeah, boys, you know, things are happening outside of Tillman.
Right.
Let's take it away.
Yeah, so Randy is keeping everything hush-hush about, like, how he got out of the...
the situation.
Child bathroom, yeah. You know, whatever went on in there, scandal.
Randy's the Randall?
Yeah, Randy got out of the Randall, and Mike is kind of, like, inquiring as to, like, how he did that, and he reiterates the importance in not snitching on anybody. And, you know, Randy's like, oh, yeah, Miss Anna has me on a short leash, like, more than ever. And Michael's, you know, like, at least you have a leash. At least you have, like, some sort of structure and, like, discipline to adhere to. Like, I'm basically, like, playing the father figure now because my mom is selling groceries for... She's selling Rice-A-Roni for drug money, and she's trying to get my Department of Public Social Services card.
Wait, is she trying to... You're saying that she's trying to get Mike's, but isn't he just holding her card
because
she's so...
Irresponsible.
Yeah, like on drugs.
Yeah.
What do you think about that commentary, like, on welfare? Because normally you see it depicted in a very negative or stereotypical light, like... Ah, welfare queen, this and that. And this is like the most real. I mean, yeah. It's The Wire, so of course it's kind of a dumb lead-in question. But what do you think? Is there like any deeper commentary, or that's just the brilliance of the show where it's just like, this is how, this is it?
Like the crazy, like, mother-son dynamic where like the son has to like be the more responsible one and like withholding the desperately needed funds from the drug addled mom. Like,
it's like, you know, when the media in certain degrees like depicts like, oh, you know, the average single mom on welfare, like they're lazy,
gaming,
they're scamming,
the system,
you know,
yeah.
And this is like literally a kid and his even younger kid brother are clinging on for, you know, life.
Dear
and this
life,
is like
the
like it's so bad he has to take control of her of the card, you know, just to like survive, and she's selling their Rice-A-Roni.
Yeah.
It's like, damn.
Definitely a more realistic depiction that kind of flips the script on the, you know, subtly racist tropes that a lot of politicians have peddled throughout the years.
Carcetti's friends.
Yeah. We'll get into
old friends.
We'll get a little into we'll get into that a little later. I feel
whoa, okay, buddy. I didn't know things have changed. Mr. Tony Gray was great. No. I'm sorry.
But yeah, we realize we kind of like finally like realize and have it spelled out for us that Bug's dad, Michael's stepdad, more or less sexually abused Michael in the past. And that's what has him like constantly so uncomfortable around like male authority figures. He comes to pick up Bug from an after school recreation center ran by
Miss Ella.
Yeah. Not the real Miss Ella from the corner. She sadly died of a stroke before this could ever be filmed, but it has to be said that like David Simon and company, you know, Richard Price wanted to pay homage to who they saw was like a great hero in the community. So
Richard Price, or
really? He was a writer on this episode, but was probably like the David Simon edition.
Hey, Richard, remember when you were on the corner with us and I
was trying to steal your ideas, clockers. I can't believe that shit was fake when they threw off the goddamn things from the roof from the fake hospital, you motherfucker.
What? Threw off things from the roof in the hospital?
Like that hospital where, like, you know, people salvage stuff, like almost like you'd think bubbles, you know, like capers.
Oh, yeah.
Where it's like they're throwing off, like the cops, right? We're throwing off old, you know, metal and stuff like that. Or the bums were doing it, but then the cops were stealing it themselves.
Jeez.
Like a reverse caper. Jeez. And then David Simon found out from that talk where like they're talking about the whites. He's like, wait, Yeah, you know, when I found out that place, like, you made up that hospital, I was like destroyed. It's like, how dare you? It wasn't real.
That's wild.
Anyways.
Where? But any yeah, so
Jesus Christ.
I'm yeah, sorry. So
rip fuel.
Things are kind of like finally laid like spelled out for us the extent of Michael's problem at home, his like pretty terrible domestic situation with the mom kind of like playing power moves with him and saying that his stepdad is going to be the one to take care of like everything from now on, and he'll have possession of the DSS card. Really kind of like brilliant reveal, because there's been like clues planted throughout of like Michael's wariness or affliction, phobia of like, you know, male father figures and stuff. And just in this brief little scene where the stepdad is like brushing his cheek and like telling him he grew up, like we get like a real, we get the whole story, like the whole backstory from it, basically.
Yeah.
Just in the brief but brilliant little brush strokes that the writers lay out for us.
Yeah. Pretty bad. I mean, and how close was Mike to taking Prez's offer for help,
right,
to the social worker, and how, you know, in the Wire universe or just throughout the show,
small moments, huge ramifications or hugely decisions. Yeah.
So
everything hinges on the little details. Got to pay attention to it. All the pieces matter. It's all connected.
Yeah. I mean, if there was any doubt, you know, into the world of Chris and Snoop and Marlo, you know, as far as Mike taking part in that,
yeah,
it's pretty much, you know, I mean, the viewer doesn't know necessarily,
right,
you know, the extent to which Mike will go to solve the issue, but pretty drastic stuff here.
Right. There's definitely some insight that we like pointed out earlier where like Marlo, Chris, and Michael like all share like the same 1,000-yard stare, like when Marlo tries to intimidate him, but then realizes like, oh shit, like I could use this guy in my crew. Like there's a kind of like a realization amongst the three of them that they share like a common trauma or whatever. But Naaman, he's like, you know, he's liking his class and like bragging about it to his friends that like, you know, he's actually like going to school to learn about something that he's interested in.
Prior, Naaman had no mind and was vialing up
in the house to the dismay of his mother. Yeah. Another like great example of like, okay, like these two people are arguing, but they're both horrible. Like Delanda's having like a heart to heart, like motherly moment with him where she's like, oh yeah, like you have drugs, but be smart about them and like go, you know, vial them up in some like other like dangerous stash house. Don't bring it home to me, like where the cops could potentially come in, raid our house, and, you know, ruin your father's fish tank that he left us before he went to jail.
So Naaman's thought process is, yeah, I'll let Kennard hold it. Like, which is also, you know, like you said, minor interactions or minor details have huge ramifications.
But it's like he's amped about like talking about business in school, but is not like really grasping the subtext that they're like trying to like slowly convert them into like being, you know, presentable to society. So he like takes the wrong lesson from it and gives Kennard some responsibility, which is let's see, what else do we have here? Can we move on to another section?
Yeah, let's just go for it.
Do we want to jump back to talking about like homicide stuff?
Yeah, sure. I mean, basically, what do we make of Bunk's mission here?
Yeah.
Is there any greater meaning? It's pretty straightforward in his attempt to do the police work, detective work that will lead to a meaningful conviction.
Yeah. I mean, you basically like stated it out. At first, he was just like, yeah, we got a eyeball witness who fucking cares. It's Almar. He murdered a bunch of people. But then, you know, he was reminded of the code. So he's like, okay, I'm not going to do Almar dirty like that. And he basically like completely shreds apart Old Face Andre's testimony, like within 2 minutes of being in his liquor store, which is like obviously like a front for drug operations. And because he's doing like that honest, good police work, negating Holly and Crutchfield's previous efforts, like that sends Jay Landsman into like a temper tantrum. And
don't unsolve murders.
Right.
But the thing I wanted to talk to you most about, pick your brain, is Old Face Andre, obviously at the center of this rehashing of the investigation, or, you know, going back over it, has a customer. What do you got for us? Because it's pretty mind-blowing. It's pretty wild, the background, right? The woman who drops by Andre, is that who? That's who you're talking about to me.
Oh yeah. So that is because okay. That is Genevieve Hudson Price, who plays Dee Dee, who shows up one episode per season from seasons 3 through 5. In season 3, she's seen buying drugs. It's season 4, she's, you know, more than likely hooked on drugs and hooking. And then in season 5, she's in recovery and like spearheading a meeting. That is Richard Price's daughter. You know,
so crazy.
Famous writer who wrote Clockers, which was, you know, arguably like one of the biggest inspirations for this show. Is written for the show before. How crazy is it for him to write this scene with his daughter in mind, where she's like talking about like working for a pimp or something? It's kind of like also foreshadowing, you know, she took part in The Deuce, which goes into that whole subculture into like in great much like greater detail. Also, like a little thing that's like indicative that Richard Price wrote this episode after Bunk tries to get Old Face Andre to come down to the station for questioning, and he's like, no, I'm not doing it. And he realizes he has a hangover. He's like, all right, give me that Mylanta, which is like the medicine that Strike had to keep drinking for his perforated stomach ulcer. So it's like little, like, you know, trinkets or clues or breadcrumbs that shows the identity of the many different voices that make up the story of the show.
Brilliant stuff. And is that the daughter? Because I distinctly remember from All the Pieces Matter that Richard Price talked about, or, you know, was interviewed about him writing for the show, and like, oh yeah, you know, my daughter, like, you know, she might, you know some of my work, or that I'm a writer. But once she found out, like, oh, you write for The Wire, she's like, hey, you're cool. Like, people know about that show at school,
about how cool my dad is.
Is that like, could that be,
I think
he has multiple kids. I'm assuming it has to be different,
right? Because the extensive research I did.
Yeah, you're
this,
really
on
yeah.
his
Deep
family.
Deep
but I
reads.
think Genevieve Hudson Price was a kid that he had from his first marriage. He might have remarried and had like kids that were younger and still in school at the time. But yeah, I remember that little anecdote he shared too, like, oh dad, like you write Almar.
Yeah. did I talk to you about your sister, your half sister? Like, that's what he's saying. Like, yeah, I also wrote like the part where your Genevieve is a prostitute. Oh, <God. laughs>
Yeah, that is pretty savage. But so yeah, Jay Landsman is like really upset about, you know, the stats being unjuked at this point.
Yeah.
And he's like, we're supposed to go from red to black, not like make it the other way around. And this is a very like heavy episode where they mention like the different numbers games that people have to play in order to like politically appease like all different parties involved. So I was wondering if maybe from that conversation you wanted to springboard into talking about the political aspect.
Oh, let's do it.
But so we are getting more of a taste of what it's like for Carchetti to be touring around like all the different beats of these different cops. So Jay Landsman is letting people know that Carchetti is going to be kind of like snooping around. And by the way, also like some brilliant writing here in this scene where he's like also mentioning the death of Colonel Raymond Forrester.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that. Is that real?
Oh, well, I mean, yeah, he like died during the filming of it, kind of similar to the whole thing that happened with Robert Colesbury and probably why they did the repeat scene of the wake, the detective's wake. But it's like, I don't know, it's pretty crazy how the writers are kind of like able to get away with like cliche sometimes, because like they're so like specific in their intention and their goals and like, you know, all the historical research and stuff, that it's able to like cut through like any of the phoniness that might be present in like other lesser cop shows. I don't want to name names, but it's like Jay is like feeling the emotion on two fronts, because he has to like kind of save face for the new mayor that's like snooping around, but he's also like really emotional about losing, you know, a powerful colleague that was really nice to him apparently. So there's like a lot of emotions that are being read on Jay Landsman's face as he's trying to power through this and still not, you know, become a blubbering mess in front of, you know, the new boss in town. Carchetti is like getting, so, you know, I've been like really hard on ragging on Carchetti in these past couple of seasons, because I like felt like he was like kind of fake in a lot of ways, and that he's just like saying all this progressive stuff to like get in and like be total political coward. But we definitely get glimpses of him in this episode believing that like the whole war on drugs thing is a failed policy choice, when he like sees it in action that like cops are just like making, you know, street rips or street level arrests just to get like a, you know, some statistics in their favor. And he, you know, calls into question the whole strategy and like if this is effective policing at all. And goddamn, dude, he turns to Rawls of all people to get like information on like what the strategy is, or, you know, the effectiveness behind all of it is. And I really forgot how like two-faced Rawls is in this whole situation, because, you know, from the very beginning of this show, we see him as like kind of like a company man, and he's all about like going by the book and, you know, just like keeping those stats like in the favor of the department. But here he's like, I mean, he's saying some like pretty despicable stuff about like affirmative action being to blame for like, you know, black cops like making more street level arrests and not doing any like more meaningful police work because, you know, they have to keep the hiring rate equal. Like, pretty off color remarks there, but
It wouldn't be the first time. Yeah.
He's like gaining a Carchetti's alliance in this moment that, like, you know, he's gonna make his move against Burrell and climb the social ladder. But it's just like kind of like a lot of detail in this scene about like the behind the scenes of manipulating statistics for people's favor.
Yeah. Pretty wild stuff.
But
I mean, and then on the street, it's mostly black cops who are making those street level arrests. Is that what you were saying? Like with the, you know, he's saying that they only are doing like busts and not really building cases.
Right.
Is that?
But that's like the antithesis of what Rawls has been about, like these last like 3 or 4 seasons, he just like realizes that a new mayor is maybe like trying to shake things up. So he has no problem with throwing his old friend under the bus.
Old Shady Rawls.
Yeah.
So I just had one thing about the whole like street bus and obviously, you know, the harsh critique of the war on drugs when they're messing with that kid who's obviously a drug addict himself.
And right.
They're talking about mandatory minimums and threatening him with sending him off to Cheltenham.
Yeah.
And the DC boys are down there and I was getting into it like, oh man, like
Geo.
Yeah. What, like, oh man, is this near Boys Village? Is this, well, I'm like, wait, I think Boys Village is in Cheltenham.
Oh,
and that is okay. That, like, it's one and the same, or they can't just be like next door to each other. So maybe that's like just a colloquial term, or I sound like a geo amateur. It can't be one or, you know, it can't be both ways. It's gotta be one or the other.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, just all pointless. I mean, what's up with the, because we were laughing about this, there was a note that I left. Because I watched this episode in 2 separate sittings, which is not advised. You know? And we know, obviously, none of you out there are average viewers. Yeah. You wouldn't do such a thing.
Right.
If anything, you'd watch it twice, to be honest.
Yeah.
And the Willie had a certain scene pause, and we were examining or re-examining, revisiting the bumper sticker on the undercover cop car used to bust the, you know, the working class guy just going, you know, going about his business. And it said, stand for justice or something.
Yeah.
Stop Roberts. And I was
stop
like,
stop John Roberts. I was like,
I have it in my notes. It says, stop Roberts. Who's Roberts? They stopped Roberts while they're on the street. And then it all came together. I mean, if there wasn't, what other sign do we need to show that this was destined to happen, this project? I mean, it all just came together right there.
Yeah.
It's like, wow. Ding, 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 ding. But what is that all about? I mean,
he's like a Supreme Court justice that was appointed by George W. Bush on October 3rd of 2005. So this like episode came out in 2006. So it's very possible that it was being filmed around the time of his appointment. So just little things like there's like things like that reinforce like the accuracy and that are peppered in that, you know, build the world of the city and all that. But then there's like little anachronisms like the whole believe sign on the trash can that Herc threw the coffee cup into.
But why would the cops be anti George Bush appointee when Santangelo's, you know, making fun of McNulty for being some kind of Democrat?
To be fair, John Roberts has proved to be like kind of like a swing vote in certain situations, but
moderate.
Like there's no way they could have known that at the time.
Yeah.
Let's see. Do you have anything else you want to talk about regarding John Roberts?
Well, what about the whole commentary? Since we're talking about Carchetti, the advisors, it's not a campaign situation, so D'Agostino is no longer there.
Yeah,
but
people from like the DNC are showing up.
Yeah, and she's high on Carchetti's chances for being, someone in the running for governor down the line, and they're really adamant that, you know, obviously crime needs to dip double digits, and he needs his name on a brick and mortar.
Yeah.
So a lot of commentary.
Yeah. And keeping your boyish good looks.
Yeah.
Just to like, you know, drive the idea home that politics is a lot more of a shallow business than people often give it credit for.
Yeah.
This is like, it's more stuff about the statistics. She's like, drop the crime rate by 10%. And then Norm is like, don't even pay attention to the schools right now because like that's not an issue you ran on. And we're seeing firsthand like how badly the school system needs help.
Yeah, that was like that caught my eye, and that's where I maybe should have added that bit about the whole like, you know, schools and previous administrations, Kurt Schmoke and all that, William Donald Schaefer. I can't go back 4 administrations. But young Tommy would have been in there. The 3rd, maybe. Obviously, it's not really commenting on who was in charge, but yeah, just devious norm, man. Just leave him alone. Tony Gray would have helped.
I know.
Or not.
Yeah,
I don't
seriously,
know.
Why isn't Carcetti, I mean, I don't know what the duties of a newly elected or, you know, Democratic, you know, presumptive new mayor entail, but like, wouldn't he want to like go around and see what's going on in the school districts and stuff? Like,
not as flashy as the drop in crime, I guess. Obviously that, you know, was Tony's thing. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, he could have served, or it's like from what we were talking about earlier with the mayor kind of taking a step away from involvement in the schools. He's like, well, Tony wants to be involved in that. He will find his way to it. Right. And that's nothing for me to, you know, have a say in, where when he could promote or endorse or appoint
right.
a superintendent.
Right.
I mean, but what happens after can get pretty wacky. So it all seems a little vague. What's going on with the old cops? Well, you already talked about it, right?
Yeah. We do have Carcetti being like really sweet on Daniels and how he wants to promote him to colonel because he feels like he's you know, really honest and got a good head on his shoulders and does a good job at, you know, good old fashioned police work. It's like kind of interesting because we see like a Carcetti's like conscience going to war with itself because like on one hand, like he's like adhering to his advisor's advice, like, okay, let's stay away from the schools, let's not touch it, it's not an issue, but you know, let's make policing more progressive. So it's like, you know, it's not just like a one size fits all solution, man. You got to look at the problem as a whole. Like, if we fix the schools, then there'll be a drop in the crime rate, most likely.
What are you, some kind of Democrat? Or... Muldoons! I almost said that the other day. That someone's like, oh, I don't do politics. Like, I don't really talk about it, you know. Mm-hmm. I'm not into it. I'm like, yeah, I'm not. Like, I don't really love participating in it, or I don't like it, you know. Whatever. But I'm like, yeah, I'm still more or less a Muldoon. And they're like, what? What?
Nice.
Nah, I'm not. I am. I'm a fraud.
But it's like you had some questions about like how Norm could not have known that Daniels was kind of like politically connected.
Well, yeah, he's like, oh, you know Daniels? He's like, no, I don't. It's like, this guy worked for the Sun for how many years? So yeah. Is this just Norm, you know, playing the game? Like, oh yeah, I don't want to get involved because I know all about his shady past and the Eastern and all that good stuff.
With Marla and all that.
Yeah, it's like, how could he not know if he was that connected?
Yeah.
And that's his job as a advisor, you know, or his right-hand man on the campaign trail to be tuned into the city.
I don't know. Like, it's kind of like we see the we witness the difference in like the approach that Ronnie has in like you know, advising Daniels on his career as opposed to Marla, because Marla was just like, play things, you know, straight by the book. You want to like advance your career, don't like rock the boat. But then Ronnie's like, fuck it, throw them all under the bus. Like, I did it, and was it Bond? The state's attorney.
Yeah,
the state's attorney like gave me a whole new like assignment. Like, I'm like crawling up. Like, you got to just like stick to your guns. And Daniels is like, chain of command. Like,
yeah. I'm a good soldier.
Exactly.
Ooh, soldier.
Still gets promoted to colonel, though, with like kind of like a uneasy alliance with Carcetti, where they're both just like going to wait and see. if they're good at their stuff. Little interesting that there's a scene where Carchetti is putting on a bulletproof vest, kind of like right after Chris and Snoop are giving their educational lesson to some young hoppers about like where to properly shoot somebody. Ooh. You know, stick to the belly or the face, because
or the dick.
Yeah, the bulletproof vest doesn't cover all that. And like in the very next scene, we see Carchetti putting on his, you know, admittedly ineffective armor.
So you're making a really sound case for us to go back to a scene-by-scene analysis of the show. Because we miss out on a lot of these gems, but Willie was brilliant enough to catch that and tie it all into our awesome episode in the making. But yeah, more education.
I know, but it's like, it's, you know, meeting kids where they're at and like talking to their interests and, you know, really educating them on the nuances of killing people in cold blood and trying to get away with it.
Walk up after, two to the head.
Right. And after...
And they're dead.
And after, you know, you quiz someone on their knowledge of Baltimore club music.
Yeah.
So, classic interaction between Chris and Snoop when they're talking about the right way to kill some of these New York people that are encroaching on their drug dealing territory.
So something tells me that Felicia Snoop Pearson might not act like, do you think she's really a fan of club? I feel like when she was talking about not really being in
92 yeah, Cube,
Snoop, no, like 92 Cube, Mark Clark. That's what the notes, it's in my notes. Right. I mean, I feel like that was, you know, from the heart.
Yeah.
In a lot of ways, they always talk about, you know, that she just brings that raw, you know, energy, being herself. Yeah. So I don't know. Maybe it's not for everyone. I mean, here at the Gods Will Not Save You, we're definitely we're all about fans.
K-Swift and
we're all about that. Rod Lee.
Yeah.
I mean, that's like hip hop stuff. But
yeah.
Yeah. I mean, all. We got love for all Baltimore artists. Hey, come on the podcast. Bank rolls.
But yeah, Chris more or less perfects his method of sniffing out a New York fake trout.
Yeah. There you go.
Oh, man. Some pretty, you know, memorable, darkly comedic interactions between the two of them. What do you make of this whole thing with like Prop Joe and Slim Charles summoning Marlo to their, you know, electronic shop at the front and like telling them that they, you know, you don't need to like get rid of all the bodies. We got to kind of like send a message. But like Prop Joe and Slim Charles are like, it seems like this is like a turning point for them where they're like, oh, we actually like really respect you. Like you're kicking at like they're like smiling at him like almost like they're like proud parents or something. I don't know.
I mean, do you think there's a more nefarious, for lack of a better word, motive behind this or meaning, where maybe they're trying to draw more attention to Marlo by asking him to not clean up the way he normally would? So that way it might connect the dots, you know, as far as the police are concerned.
I didn't even think about it from that angle.
Just thought of that. Like, let me just be a contrarian and like, like mess with Willie. Yeah. They probably have a bunch of reasons to wake up each day and think, you know, this is the day that something could go very wrong.
Right.
You know, for whatever reason. And then now you throw in Marlo to the mix and it's like, man, this guy's really crazy. Like I could just disappear forever.
Right.
So, but I know Slim Charles is, you know, Slim Charles and Prop Joe is well connected.
Yeah.
So maybe they don't, you know, think about those things. That's just me having like my anxieties that like Chris and Snoop are going to show up like in a dark alley one day.
Right.
Freak me out.
Mm-hmm. Ask you if you like Shake and Jiggle It by Young Leek. But Yeah, and then Prop Joe even goes to bat for Marlo and does like a, you know, Robert Chu is showing off that like he really did like have like extensive like vocal training as like an opera singer because he like,
oh yeah,
man, he does like a Looney Tunes style rundown of what are some of the names he gives, like Hand Jerker. Yeah.
He did it.
Pepper and Bailey.
Yeah, but basically putting on like all these comical Looney Tunes style voices to get to the bottom of like what Herc's deal is, and you know, maybe this is like a good way to kind of like transition into like the whole storyline with Herc. Herky Mauserman.
Dozer Merc.
Yeah. Herc is kind of like running a targeted harassment campaign against them now.
Chris Snarlo.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, he's harassing. He's doing a harassment.
He's doing a harassment.
Yeah, Herc is doing a harassment. He's just targeting the hell out of them.
Right. He's catching blowback from Mary Mao because of that woman that they arrested at the train station under the false pretense that she was giving Marlo cocaine. But Marlo, of course, was running a whole con on them. So then Herc is...
Yeah, I'm going to be back. I'll be fucking... What's this powder back here? Yeah. Huh? Oh, that's like lime. Boston.
Yeah. Yeah, that's lime from my mom's house. I'm not using that. To...
What if he said, oh, yeah, I got that from your mom's garden. Ah.
That would have been really hilarious.
I think Herc would have beaten him.
But yeah, so since Herc lost the camera, he's like doing a no holds barred approach to like fucking with Marlo. Marlo's fucking with him back, saying like, oh, you know, who knows where the camera is, it could be lost like pigeons in a storm, knowing full well that Herc probably saw the footage of Marlo's little pigeon coop and, you know, endless little cat and mouse game, which Herc doesn't have the mental capacity for, really.
Dude, what if Mary Mel got a job as a stevedore and they called him Mary Maui?
Ooh, nice.
And then he had to fight the ghost of Ziggy.
Ooh, nice. But like Herc and Caliccio and Dozerman are like doing the shit where they like just show up to the spot and like, you know, kick shit over and like harass people. And they're like, oh, yeah, this is great.
Yeah.
Just like the old days. And it's like, oh, yeah, they don't seem to realize that that was never effective and didn't get shit any done. It's just the... an outlet for them to express their range. Like that's the accomplishment they get from it.
They're over there doing things like the Western DEU, but in West Baltimore or on the East Side, the real location of Marlo's court.
Oh, nice.
You're
done. You're doing your geo.
Even better here. Well, I got a question for you.
Nice.
So, you know, while they're harassing, Marlo and his crew, one of those individuals is O-Dog.
Yeah.
And he's getting roughed up by Caliccio combination, you know, Herc too. I like to call him Herc-Caliccio.
Yeah, it's really brilliant.
And I just wanted to ask if, you know, this experience here is something that the actor who plays O-Dog, Daryl Britt Gibson,
yeah,
will call back upon as he plays Jamel Ram in We Own This City, one of the disgraced cops in the Gun Trace Task Force.
Oh, man, it's going to be great. I mean, he's already like a pretty solid actor. I saw him pop up in the Fear Street trilogy on Netflix as like a mall security guard, this time with like a little bit more comedy chops under his belt. So I'm looking forward to seeing him in that performance. Maybe there's a lot of like pent up rage that he got from having to act with Dominic Lombardozzi.
Yeah, it's going to come out. He was also in Judas and the Black Messiah, right?
Oh, yeah. And Barry, the show. Herc at one point stops Chris and Snoop as they're driving, and they have like a little super secret electronic glove compartment that they could put their gun away in. And he hassles them all about, you know, like, I want my fucking camera back. And he shoots a nail from Snoop's famous nail gun into the street, which is gonna have consequences down the line. That, you know, causes Chris and Snoop to eventually make the hard decision of throwing their nail gun into the harbor to get rid of all the evidence. But after, like, all this, you know, random goose chasing and, like, really, like, not getting any results, Herc has the out-of-the-box idea to go after little Kevin based on, like, what Randy told him offhandedly in a previous conversation, and that's gonna permanently fuck Randy's up life forever, pretty much.
Yeah, it's like you said, really small moments here have huge ramifications, and it's like, what chance is it that Herc is able to actually remember, just off the top of his head, that is what Randy said? You know, is that wild of me to think that, like, damn, it's crazy, like, Herc was actually smart enough to remember that, like, oh yeah, little Kevin, like, how many nicknames do you think is already in his thick head, you know?
Right. But it's like, I mean, and on one hand he's smart enough to remember it, but at the same time he's like really dumb to even think that. Yeah. That's like a potential lead. Yeah,
and how it will work out really well for the kid who, you know, who told him the lead. But it's like, this is just Herc in a nutshell.
Yeah, Herc definitely solidifies himself as kind of a bad guy this season with, like, a lot of his decisions.
Shout out Dominic Lombardozzi. Unfortunately, I struck out with my prediction or hypothesis. Oh, yeah. Everyone, it was me, if you're following the socials, who thought that he might be playing Step.
Yeah,
Donald Step.
In We Own This City.
But he's, of course, going to be the FOP president. So finally he can get his chance at displaying Bodhi's nuts on the mantle at the FOP lodge.
Nice.
All right. Nah, that was a really fun conversation.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, thanks everybody for sticking with us to the end there. Again, if you like what we're throwing at you, you could always follow us on the social media. We're at The Gods Will Not Save You on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram.
Yeah, thanks so much for plugging that, Willie. And also feel free to reach us at the email, which is thegodswillnotsaveyou@gmail.com. One day I will figure out the two-step authentication and get back in so I can participate. If anyone wants to reach out. So good stuff.
And also, we always want to give a very special shout out and thank you to our incredible composer, Mostart, who did our intro and outro music and some of the bumpers. Great guy. You could check out his entire catalog at mostart.com.
Also, a big shout out to our very talented graphic designer, Andre, who hooked it up with the very legit emblem. I almost said album because you were talking about mostart.com. Yeah. But yeah, big shout out to Andre. Good stuff, bud.
All right, great. Thanks, everybody. We'll talk to you next time.